This is Mountain Edition, all of this week's news from the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome, here with our summer production intern, Ryer Garden-Schwartz. Hi, Ryer.
Hi, Zoe. This week, the effort to increase oil and gas setbacks from schools and homes in Colorado is facing pushback.
A Colorado food bank delivers boxes of food to low-income seniors.
And tenants of affordable housing in Aspen can now expect random compliance checks.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. The effort to increase oil and gas setbacks from schools and homes in Colorado is having a tough week. For Aspen Public Radio, Matt Bloom has more.
Speaking at an energy industry luncheon on Thursday, former U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar didn't hold back. He said he opposes Initiative 97, which aims to take new well setbacks from 500 feet to 2,500 feet.
It's fundamentally, in my view, unconstitutional. And it's a regulatory taking that I don't think anybody wants to buy into. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Colorado Rising, the group behind 97, is also accusing its signature gathering firm of stealing seven boxes of petitions. Those contained thousands of signatures for the proposed ballot measure. The two parted ways earlier this week after payment conflicts. The firm did not return our request for comment. The final deadline to turn in petitions for inclusion on the November election ballot is August 6th, a spokeswoman for Colorado Rising says they're confident they'll have enough to qualify. I'm Matt Bloom in Denver.
136 Valley seniors received food support from the Food Bank of the Rockies, and more may be eligible. 86 seniors in Pickens County alone currently receive nutrition assistance in the form of free monthly boxes. The packages contain juice, cereal, as well as canned fruits and vegetables.
Many seniors struggle with low fixed incomes while the price of medicine, transportation, and housing increases. As seniors lose their mobility and independence, shopping for groceries becomes more of a struggle. Food assistance programs are often aimed at helping families, leaving out the elderly. To qualify, seniors need proof of address, income, and identification. Food is available for pickup at food banks and mobile pantries in Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties.
The Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority has hired a full-time compliance manager. As Allison Bechtesh reports, it's the first time in the program's 40-year history that a dedicated staff member will be making sure APCHA's tenants are following the rules.
Bethany Spitz started in the role this week. She's a Valley local, most recently working for the Aspen Skiing Company. She herself lives in workforce housing.
I think APCHA provides such a powerful benefit to the Aspen community. It's important for our community to have employee housing that is affordable.
Spitz's role includes investigating reported violations of deed restrictions and conducting random compliance audits. Tenants within the APCHA system agree to certain guidelines, including full-time work requirements within Pitkin County, and they're not allowed to list their homes on short-term rental sites. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
This November, the Aspen Fire Protection District will be asking voters for a millage increase. The district is asking for a property tax increase of 1.25 mils, or $3 million annually. The money would go to maintaining and buying equipment, as well as building affordable housing for volunteer firefighters. It would also help fund pensions for the 37 volunteers and 7 full-time fire department staff.
Taxes in the district haven't been raised since 1953, and even with this increase, it will remain the lowest mill levy rate in the state, and it could conflict with the state's Gallagher Amendment, which is slated to cut property taxes by as much as 15% next year. There are 4 fire stations for almost 90 square miles in the Upper Valley, with a 5th already funded on its way. The U.S. Geological Survey keeps track of how much water flows through rivers and streams across the country to help plan for shortages, or at the other extreme, brace for floods. But there are more waterways than the agency is able to keep track of. So recently, they added a new tool that will not only help them cover more ground, but also help them learn more about this precious resource, all without ever touching a drop. H2O Radio has more.
Did you go river rafting this summer? If you did, maybe you wondered how the outfitters knew it was safe to be on the water and whether you were in for a wild ride. Well, before professional operators decide to get on a river, they check how much water is in the channel and how fast it's moving. They do that by using data from stream gauges, mechanical devices that measure water levels and flow rates. There are about 8,000 of these gauges scattered around the country, and we're standing next to one a few miles west of Canyon City, Colorado, along the Arkansas River. This particular gauge, which looks a little bit like a small grain silo, is super important to outfitters because it's just upstream of the Royal Gorge, rafting terrain not for the faint of heart, with steep drops through a canyon and Class 5 rapids.
I've never been, but I've been told that it gets quite narrow and extremely fast.
That's John Fulton from the U.S. Geological Survey. His agency monitors these gauges, and he says they still work pretty well, given that the first one was established some 130 years ago near the town of Embuto, New Mexico, where it records flows on the Rio Grande. So who uses this information besides rafters and kayakers?
Much of the information we collect is used by cooperators such as the National Weather Service for flood forecasting, the U.S. Corps of Engineers for some of their reservoir operations, and the Bureau of Reclamation's reservoir operations. It's used by the Forest Service for forest hydrology.
The gauges provide valuable insights that range from helping utilities plan to warning of a potential dangerous flood. But to get other information, like, say, temperature or the amount of particulates in a river, USGS scientists have to get in the water or use boats to collect data. That's not only labor-intensive, but it also only provides data for one fixed location, leaving many remote places unmapped. Also, it can be a bit risky to wade into fast-moving water.
A lot of our scientists and hydrologists and hydrotechnicians really risk themselves under certain conditions by getting data that's being used by other agencies.
So about 2 years ago, USGS started looking for other ways to collect data. That's the sound of what Fulton fondly calls his QCAM. It's an unmanned aerial system, or what the rest of us would call a drone or a quadcopter. However, this one has a very special payload that's being tested today. While your drone might have a GoPro camera, this one's got Doppler radar attached.
So this radar, it is the only one on the planet right now that is capable of collecting these velocity measurements in this kind of a platform. And we will hover over the channel, the surface water, and we'll collect velocity data.
The drone will run a zigzag pattern over the river and send back data that Fulton can then compare to what was collected by the stream gauge, all without anyone dipping a toe in the water.
The big advantage of using a drone over a manned aircraft is that you take the human factor out of it, right? No one gets hurt, everybody goes home at the end of the day.
That's Todd Burton, who is assisting Fulton today, and someone who might possibly have one of the coolest jobs ever.
I work for the U.S. Geological Survey's National Unmanned Aircraft Project office in Denver, and the majority of my work is flying unmanned aircraft and then processing the data that we collect from those aircraft.
Yep, he flies drones for a living. Well, it's more than that. He's in charge of a fleet of remotely piloted aircraft, which range from small quadcopters to fixed-wing aircraft to even unmanned helicopters for larger payloads. So how does he decide which aircraft to use for which job?
The size of the area of the project is a determining factor. All of our aircraft run off of batteries. They're not gas-powered. So we're usually anywhere from 10 to 45 minutes, depending on the aircraft. Of course, if you have a manned helicopter, you could stay up for hours and get larger swaths of land done.
The weather is a determining factor, too. He can't fly in strong winds like manned aircraft can. Also, it's over 100 degrees out here today. And because we're about a mile above sea level, the air pressure and heat make the aircraft think it's at 10,000 feet. And that's too much for these little guys to get off the ground. Also, Burton says he has to factor in the curious public. A small low-flying drone wouldn't grab the attention that a hovering helicopter would.
We're right next to a highway. We're over a river. We're in a canyon. There's lots of factors here that you want to look at if you were in, a manned helicopter. Be going low and slow. With the highway here, get a lot of looky-loos that can cause accidents.
The ability of a drone to hover close to the ground gives it an advantage over manned aircraft. Plus, it's a lot cheaper than having a scientist rent a plane. USGS is continuing to develop new sensors and cameras to put on its fleet and sending them to places that were previously hard to reach.
We have a drone with a hyperspectral camera on it, and we'll be testing it later this summer, but the thought is that you may be able to judge the amount of sediment and water. There's also something called green LIDAR, which is essentially a laser that can penetrate through water. So we don't know if any of this works yet, but that's part of our job, is to assist the scientists to see if we can make it work, and if not, what can we change to get it to work correctly.
The wish list from scientists is growing every day, Burton says. For example, they're testing cameras that are multispectral that can look at different wavelengths to allow scientists to judge the amount of water stress in plants, something that would be useful in agriculture.
People just are dreaming up stuff every day. We have folks that want to try and use a ground penetrating radar system on one. And just sort of looking at all different types of things. If you can think it up and somebody can shrink it down, then we can probably get it on the aircraft.
Yes, it's all about minimizing because the aircraft can only carry so much weight. But no one is minimizing the potential of these new tools to give us a whole new perspective on the world around us. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Ryer Gardenswerts. And Zoe, we know that people listening to Mountain Edition want to stay up to date on local news.
Absolutely. And one of the ways they can do this is by checking out Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page to get updates on the latest news from across the valley.
You can interact with our station through comments on our posts or even message us directly.
Find us by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. Incident team that's been in charge of the Lake Christine fire for the past several weeks passed the baton to a smaller incident management team Tuesday night. The fire is now at 90% containment, and it's believed to be a less complex fire than before. Crews have been disassembled and reassigned to other fires. Residents of Basalt and El Jebel can expect to see a decrease in air support over the next few days.
Water managers are boosting flows in the Frying Pan and Roaring Fork rivers. Low flows this season have caused problems for farmers and fish alike. The Colorado River District, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are working together to increase flows downstream from Rudi Reservoir.
Anticipated releases are expected to range between 50 and 100 cubic feet per second. The increased flows should lower water temperatures for trout, who thrive at between 45 and 65 degrees. Colorado Parks and Wildlife announced voluntary fishing closures earlier this month on sections of the Colorado and Roaring Fork rivers. Those will remain in place.
Jazz Aspen Snowmass has announced that it expects to purchase the second floor of the Red Onion Building and adjacent second floor spaces. The proposed JAS Center would include a Cooper Street Mall entrance. The space is slated to include facilities for jazz education programming, private and public event space, as well as a 200-seat theater.
The property purchase and its new construction are projected to cost $15 million. JAS has expressed interest in partnering with the City of Aspen to buy the space. That partnership has come into question after council showed hesitancy about allocating $5 million for the JAS facility purchase. Those funds would need to be approved in a public vote, but a drawn-out purchase process caused JAS to miss the deadline to get a ballot measure together for November's election, further jeopardizing a public-private partnership.
For over a century, the Turnbull family has been ranching in the Roaring Fork Valley. They have also been competing in Carbondale's Wild West Rodeo since its start in the mid-1950s, passing down their love of competition and Western tradition from generation to generation.
Matt and Bruce Turnbull are waiting for their signal to start. They're both on horseback and carrying stiff ropes to wrangle the calf that's waiting between them. The chute opens and the calf bursts out with Matt in pursuit. He twirls his rope overhead and sends it flying in the cow's direction, catching it by the horn. Bruce is just behind, trying to snare the calf's hoof in his own spinning rope. He casts his lasso and barely misses. The calf dashes across the dirt, rope trailing from one horn. The father and son exit the arena at a trot, lassos in hand. Contestants must pay to enter and get a chance to win back cash in competition. Bruce says that's just part of rodeo.
You drive 12 hours to rodeo and you miss. You don't make any money and you drive home.
That is the heartbreak of rodeo. The Turnbulls are competing in calf roping, a sport that pits two cowbokes and lassos against a loose calf and the clock to see who can get a rope around the calf's horn and hooves the fastest. Rodeo is a uniquely practical sport. It's competition based on the daily chores required for ranch work. Calf roping, for example, allows cowboys to catch and care for their cattle. Matt says it's all part of the job.
You can also take $30 and turn it into $500 doing what you do on a day-to-day basis, if you're fast.
The Turnbulls Ranch is just off Prince Creek Road in Carbondale, where they've been ranching in the shadow of Mount Sopris for decades.
Rodeo, for us, is a reflection of what we do on a daily basis. Horsemanship is key. It is fun to be able to go out in the evening and do that in a competition form.
The Turnbulls have been ranching in the Roaring Fork Valley since 1880. Bruce is 18, a fifth-generation rodeo cowboy. He learned roping from his father, who learned it from his father, who learned it from his father. Different generations compete with and against one another. Young guns pitted against old hands.
For me, being younger, it's a lot of fun because I have a lot of friends that are young, and it's a way of, competing with the older people, our dads, and we can compete with them and against them.
The Carbondale Wild West Rodeo began as the Carbondale Roping Club in 1954, founded by Bob and Diddy Perry, Matt's grandparents. A poster bearing the family name hangs on the rodeo grounds, and a gazebo memorializes their love for the sport. More than a competition, it's also about the relationship between ranchers and their livestock. That's just another part of what makes rodeo so special, according to Roz Turnbull, daughter of founders Bob and Diddy.
There's such a bond between animals and people, and they care for the animals and spend a lot of time taking care of them.
Her son, Matt, says the rodeo also acts as a sort of hub for the agricultural community. Ranchers can live hours away from the nearest town.
It brings together a group of people within the valley that you wouldn't see on a day-to-day basis.
And this is important for a community steeped in tradition. Rodeo is as old as ranching. It is still evolving. It gets more competitive every year. Roz says this tradition is here to stay.
The last cowboy certainly hasn't passed on.
Standing outside the Carbondale Rodeo, that much is clear. A large crowd is gathered to watch generations of cowpokes, from toddling mutton busters to mature bronc riders, compete in one of the last vestiges of the Wild West. Zoe Rome, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mariah Gardenswartz.
And I'm Zoe Rome. You can find our content online at aspenpublicradio.org, along with a conversation between Secretary Madeleine Albright and Dan Porterfield of the Aspen Institute for this week's McCloskey Speaker Series. Hear that conversation at aspenpublicradio.org.
This week's stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Parts of Colorado are experiencing the worst drought conditions in more than a decade. For Aspen Public Radio, Luke Runyon has more.
The severity of the drought depends on where you look. On the state's western slope, a lack of rain and high temperatures have caused some streams to run at record low levels. And conditions are getting worse in areas of the state's eastern plains. Christine Mergelman is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and works with ranchers in Elbert County. She says they're already beginning to move cattle onto winter pastures because the grass on their summer range is stunted.
So now we're in a problem that it's so dry that what are we going to do when it gets that time? They're starting to sell. It's not good.
Elsewhere on the plains, frequent hailstorms have caused damage to corn and vegetable crops. The only bright spot is in the northeast and on the northern Front Range, where recent cool and wet weather has kept rivers from dipping too low. For KUNC, I'm Luke Runyon.
There's a group of Mid-Valley residents that's had it with Eagle County. Our Valley, Our Voice wants Basalt, Willits, and Elgebel to join neighboring Picken County. As Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm reports, leaving one county to join another is no easy task.
Tim Witzit thinks the Eagle County commissioners are a little tone deaf to what the Roaring Fork Valley is all about.
They don't have the same understanding and feelings about development as we have here.
The commissioners have approved some controversial developments. Witzit, for the record, does think that development is important. However,
on the other hand, it's absolutely wrong to pave the entire valley floor with five-story condominiums.
Witzit lives in Basalt. His wife is the mayor. He and a few others have formed Our Valley, Our Voice. They want the Mid-Valley to join Pitkin County.
My experience with them is that they're more serious about keeping a rural landscape.
If this happens, if Pitkin County annexes the portion of the Roaring Fork Valley currently in Eagle County, it will end a debate that's nearly as old as the counties themselves.
I have a copy of a newspaper article from 1897 saying that portion of Eagle County really belongs more logically with Pitkin County.
Kathy Chandler Henry is an Eagle County commissioner. She'll admit it is kind of random that a little slice of the Roaring Fork Valley is in Eagle County. It's expensive, too. They spend more on providing services here, like a sheriff's deputy, public health offices, and so on, than they get back in taxes.
It would be a revenue gain for Eagle County if that portion were to annex into Pitkin County.
For this to happen, a majority of voters in both counties would need to approve it. But, of course, the question needs to get on the ballot. And that's tricky because of a statute from 1887. It demands that 50% of voters in the area to be annexed sign a petition.
It is an onerous and monumental task.
That's getting 5,000 signatures. Witzit and several other members of Our Valley, Our Voice spent an hour or two collecting signatures outside of Whole Foods recently. They got 50.
Well, multiply that out 100 times. It's several hundred hours of work.
And not everyone in the Mid-Valley wants to join Pitkin County.
I have heard that Pitkin County is extremely difficult to work with.
Robert Hubble manages the Elgebel Mobile Home Park. He says Eagle County has approved some affordable housing projects without forcing him to jump through too many hoops.
There's too much paperwork in Pitkin County.
And what about Pitkin County? Does it even want this? When its commissioners and staff discussed annexation in June, there was lots of skepticism.
It would be a significant undertaking.
I have great hesitancy about this.
I really don't see any benefit for Pitkin County and Pitkin County residents.
Pitkin County Manager John Peacock estimates annexing the Mid-Valley would increase the county's population by over 40% and cost them millions each year to get services to the new residents. Tim Witzit questions these numbers. And he also says, what's the harm in just asking?
I don't put a lot of weight in what either the Pitkin County commissioners or the Eagle County commissioners think. I want to hear what the voters have to say.
On Tuesday, Whitsitt and other members of Our Valley, Our Voice met with the Eagle County commissioners. They urged them to put the question on November's ballot directly, disregarding the 1887 statute requiring petitions. The commissioners didn't bite. Jeannie McQueenie said petitioning is the best way to hear all voices from Eagle County's little sliver of the valley.
The right thing to do is to let the people who live in that section of the county decide. And they decide that through petition. Do they want that on their ballot?
After the meeting, Whitsitt said it's unlikely Our Valley, Our Voice can collect the 5,000 signatures in time for this fall's election. The next chance to do so would be in 2020, adding two more years to a discussion that's over a century old. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
The documentary, The Price of Everything, will be screened tonight in Aspen. As Kristen Kay reports, the film takes a critical look at the contemporary art market.
Longtime Aspen local Jennifer Stockman produced the film, which features interviews with collectors, dealers, auctioneers, and artists. Sue Simon is the managing director of the Aspen Institute Arts Program. She says the film will inspire the audience to think about what happens when art and commerce are deeply connected.
I think without being judgmental, it raises issues about what is the price of art? How can one price art? Is it even possible to price art?
After the screening, director Nathaniel Kahn will join Stockman to discuss the creation of the film. Tonight's screening is an opportunity to see The Price of Everything before its wider release. HBO has purchased the rights to the documentary. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Governor John Hickenlooper wants the federal government to withdraw a new rule that restricts conversations that healthcare professionals can have with their patients. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel has more.
The governor sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Monday to withdraw the Compliance with Statutory Program Integrity Requirements rule. The new rule would limit how providers who receive Title X federal funding discuss reproductive health care options with their patients. Under the proposed plan, a healthcare professional will not be allowed to refer a pregnant woman to an abortion provider, even if she asks. And Title X clinics would no longer have to offer a full range of FDA-approved contraceptive methods. For example, a healthcare center could provide only abstinence counseling or natural family planning and still receive federal funding. In his letter, Hickenlooper says the rule puts politicians in the exam room and limits the information doctors can provide. Every woman in Colorado, quote, deserves to speak openly with their doctor and make the healthcare decisions that are best for them. For KUNC, I'm Stephanie Daniel.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Ryer Garden-Swartz. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in to Aspen Public Radio tomorrow at 3:30 for a live broadcast of Valley Roundup. Host Allison Bechtesh is joined by reporters throughout the valley to discuss the stories behind this week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.